Jared's perception was occupied with other things. The location of his squadmates, the rate of his descent, and the maneuvering required to ensure he was both where he needed to be at landing and yet well out of the way when certain events transpired not too far in the future. Locating his squadmates was the easiest task. Every member of the 2nd Platoon was blanked out visually and through most of the electromagnetic spectrum by their black-body nanobiotic unitards and equipment covers, save for a small tight-beam transmitter receiver each platoon member wore. These polled the position of the other platoon members before the jump and continued doing so at microsecond intervals since. Jared knew that Sarah Pauling was 40 meters fore and starboard, Daniel Harvey 60 meters below, and Jane Sagan 200 meters above, the last out of their transport. The first time Jared participated in a nighttime high-altitude jump, not long after Gettysburg, he managed to lose the tight-beam signal and landed several clicks away from his squad, disoriented and alone. He received no end of shit for that. Jared's final destination lay now less than 25 clicks below him, highlighted by his brain pal, which also offered up a descent pathway computed to get him where he needed to be. The pathway was updated on the fly as the brain pal took into consideration wind gusts and other atmospheric phenomena. It also tracked carefully around three closely grouped virtual columns superimposed on Jared's vision. These columns stretched down from the heavens to terminate in three areas of a single building, the Hierarch's Palace, which served as both the residence of Phileb Ser and her court, and the official seat of the government. What these three columns represented became apparent when Jared and the 2nd Platoon had descended to less than 4 kilometers, and three particle beams appeared in the sky, lancing downward from the satellites the Special Forces had positioned in low orbit above Anisha. One beam was dim, one furiously bright, and the third was dimmest of all, and with a curious flicker. The citizenry of Derlu cooed over the sight and the resonant thunderclap wall of sound that accompanied their appearance. In their simultaneously heightened and diminished state of awareness, they thought the beams were part of the city's light show. Only the invaders and the actual coordinators of Derlu's light show initially knew any different. Particle beam-producing satellites are not something the Anisha Planetary Defense Grid would have failed to notice. Noticing enemy weapons is what planetary defense grids are for. In this particular case, however, the satellites were well disguised as a trio of repair tugs. The tugs had been planted months earlier, not long after the incident at Gettysburg, as part of the routine service fleet for the Colonial Union's diplomatic berths at one of Enisha's three major space stations. They did, in fact, work perfectly fine as tugs. Their rather unusually modified engines were not apparent externally or by internal systems checks, the latter due to clever software modifications that hid the engine's capabilities to all but the most determined of investigators. The three tugs had been assigned to haul in the kite after the ship appeared in Enishan space and asked for permission to repair damage done to its hull and systems after a recent battle with an Array cruiser. The kite had won the exchange, but had to retreat before its damage could be totally repaired. The kite had picked a fight at one of the Array's more moderately defended colonies, where the military strength was strong enough to repel a single Special Forces craft, but not strong enough to blast it wholly out of the sky. A routine courtesy tour of the kite for the Enishon military was offered by its commander, but declined as a matter of course by the Enishon military, who had already confirmed the kite's story through its informal intelligence channels with the RA. The kite also asked for and received permission for members of its crew to have shore leave at Tresh, a resort that had been set aside for Colonial Union diplomats and staff stationed on Enisha. Tresh lay to the southeast of Derlu, which was just north of the flight path the troop transport carrying 2 squads worth of vacationing members of the 2nd Platoon had filed. As the troop transport passed near Derlu, it reported an atmospheric disturbance and changed course northward to avoid Chop, edging briefly into the no-fly zone over the Derlu airspace. and the Shawn Transport Command noted the correction but required the transport to return to its previous flight plan as soon as it edged past the turbulence. The transport did, its load 2 squads lighter, a few minutes later. It was interesting what you could do when your enemy was officially your ally, and unaware you knew it was your enemy. The particle beams seared forth from the tugs assigned to the kite and struck the Hierarch's palace. The first, the strongest of the beams by a significant margin, tore through 6 levels of palace into the guts of the place to vaporize the palace's backup generator and, 20 meters below that, the main power line. Severing the main power line switched the palace's electrical systems to the backup, which had been destroyed milliseconds earlier. In the absence of centralized backup power, various local backups sprang to life and locked down the palace through a system of security doors. The designers of the palace's electrical and security systems reasoned that if both the main power and the backup power were taken down, the entire palace itself would probably be under attack. This was correct as far as it went. What the designers did not expect or intend was for the decentralized system of local backups to play an integral part in the attacker's plans. This beam caused relatively little secondary damage. Its energies were tuned specifically to stay contained within its circumference and to bore deep into the Enishon ground. The resulting hole was more than 80 yards deep before some of the debris thrown up from the beam's work, and some of the debris from the 6 levels of palace, filled the bottom of the hole to a depth of several meters. The second beam pierced the palace's administrative wing. Unlike the first beam, this beam was tuned wide and designed to throw off a massive amount of waste heat. The administrative wing of the palace buckled and sweated where the beam struck. Superheated air tore through the offices, blasting wide doors and windows and igniting everything inside with a combustion point below 932 degrees centigrade. More than 3 dozen Enishon night shift government workers, military guards, and janitors immolated, broiling instantly within their carapaces. The Hierarch's private office and everything in it, directly in the focused center of the beam, turned to ash only fractions of a second before the firestorm the beam's heat and energy created blew those ashes to all corners of the rapidly deconstructing wing. The second beam was by far the most destructive, but the least critical of the 3 beams. The Special Forces certainly didn't intend or expect to assassinate the Hierarch in her private office. She was rarely in it on any evening and would absolutely not have been in it on this night, when she was attending to public functions as part of the Chafalan celebrations. She was on the other side of Derlu entirely. It would have been a clumsy attempt at best. But the Special Forces wanted it to look like a clumsy attempt on the Hierarch's life, so the Hierarch and her immense and formidable personal security detail would be kept far from the palace while the 2nd Platoon accomplished its actual goal. The 3rd beam had the lowest power of any of them, and flickered as it surgically battered away at the roof of the palace, like a surgeon cauterizing and removing skin, 1 layer at a time. The goal of this beam was not terror or wholesale destruction, but to cut a direct pathway to a palace chamber, in which resided the 2nd Platoon's goal, and the lever that, it was hoped, would serve to pry the Enishons out of their tripartite plan to attack humanity. "We're going to kidnap what now?" asked Daniel Harvey. "We're going to kidnap Viut Ser," Jane Sagan said, "heir to the Enishon throne." Daniel Harvey gave a look of sheer incredulousness, and Jared was reminded why Special Forces soldiers, despite their integration, actually bothered to meet physically for briefings. In the end, nothing could really top body language. Sagan forwarded the intelligence report on the mission and the mission specs, but Harvey piped up again before the information could unpack completely. "Since when have we gotten into the kidnapping business?" Harvey said. "That's a new wrinkle." "We've done abductions before," Sagan said. "This is nothing new." "We've abducted adults," Harvey said. And generally speaking, they've been people who mean us harm. This kidnapping actually involves a kid. It's more like a grub, said Alex Rentgen, who by now had unpacked the mission briefing and had begun to go through it. Whatever, Harvey said. Grub, kid, child. The point is, we're going to use a young innocent as a bargaining chip. Am I right? And that's the first time we've done that. It's scummy. This from the guy who usually has to be told not to blow shit up, Rentgen said. Harvey glanced over to Rentgen. That's right, he said. I usually am the guy you have to tell not to blow shit up, and I'm telling you that this mission stinks. What the fuck is wrong with the rest of you? Our enemies don't have the same high standards as you, Harvey, Julie Einstein said, and forwarded a picture of the pile of children's corpses at Gettysburg. Jared shivered again. Does that mean we have to have the same low standards as they do? Harvey said. Look, Sagan said. This isn't up to a vote. Our intelligence people tell me the RA, the Anishans, and the Oban are getting close to a big push into our space. We've been harassing the RA and the Oban on the margins, but we haven't been able to move against the Anishans because we're still working under the polite fiction that they're our allies. This has given them the time to prepare, and despite all the disinformation we've been feeding them, they still know too much about where our weak points are. We've got solid intelligence that says the Anishans are right up front on any plan of attack. If we move against the Anishans openly, all three of them will be at our necks, and we don't have the resources to fight them all. Harvey's right. This mission takes us into new territory, but none of our alternative plans have the same impact this one does. We can't break the Anishans militarily, but we can break them psychologically. By this time, Jared had absorbed the entire report. We're not stopping with kidnapping, he said to Sagan. No, Sagan said. Kidnapping alone won't be enough to make the Hierarch agree to our terms.
Christ, Harvey said.
He had finally absorbed the entire briefing.
This shit stinks!
It beats the alternative, Sagan said. Unless you really think the Colonial Union can take on three enemies at once.
Can I just ask one question? Said Harvey. Why do we get stuck with this crap?
We're special forces, Sagan said. This is the sort of thing we do.
Bullshit, Harvey said. You said it yourself. We don't do this. Nobody does this. We're being made to do this because no one else wants to do this.
Harvey looked around in the briefing room.
Come on, we can admit this, to ourselves at least, he said. Some real-born asshole in military intelligence thought up this plan, and then a bunch of real-born generals signed off on it, and then the Colonial Defense Force's real-born commanders didn't want to have anything to do with it, so we get it, and everyone thinks we won't mind because we're a bunch of 2-year-old amoral killers. Well, I have morals, and I know everyone in this room does too. I won't back away from a stand-up fight. All of you know that about me. But this isn't a stand-up fight. This is bullshit. First-class bullshit.
All right, it's bullshit, Sagan said. But this is also our mission. Don't ask me to be the one who snatches the thing, Harvey said. I'll have the back of whoever does it, but that's one cup I'll ask to have passed from me. I won't ask you, Sagan said. I'll find something else for you to do.
Who are you going to get to do the deed? Alex Rentgen said.
I'll do it myself, Sagan said. I'll want 2 volunteers to go with me.
I already said I'd have you back, Harvey said.
I need someone who will make the snatch if I get a bullet in the head, Harvey, Sagan said.
I'll do it, Sarah Pauling said.
Harvey's right that this shit stinks, though.
Thank you, Pauling, Harvey said.
You're welcome, Pauling said. Don't get cocky.
That's one, Sagan said. Anyone else?
Everyone in the briefing room turned to look at Jared.
What?
Jared said, suddenly defensive.
Nothing, said Julie Einstein. It's just that you and Pauling are usually a matched pair.
Well, that's not true at all, Jared said. We've been with the platoon for 7 months now, and I've had all your backs at one time or another.
Don't get worked up about it, Einstein said. No one said you were married, and you have had all our backs. But everyone tends to pair off on missions with one person more than others. I get paired with Rentgen. Sagan gets stuck with Harvey because no one else wants to deal with him. You pair up with Pauling, that's all.
Stop teasing Jared, Pauling said, smiling. He's a nice guy, unlike the rest of you degenerates.
We're nice degenerates, Rentgen said.
Or nicely degenerate anyway, said Einstein.
If we're all done with our fun, Sagan said, I still need another volunteer.
Dirac, Harvey prompted.
Stop already, Sagan said.
No, Jared said. I'll do it.
Sagan seemed about to object, but stopped herself.
Fine, she said.